We are.
Well, there is no music, so guess what? We're going to jump right into this. We're starting out.
Hi. Great. I thought you were going to break into song and start singing for us.
You know, I almost did. So welcome, everybody, to Drive Through HR. And we're going to have a great show, by the way, William, Brian, and Nisha, and Angela today. Since we have no music, you're part of the show. You're a guest host, even. So let's kick it off. We'd love to talk to HR every single day. Let's get to our guest because, man, she has got so much good to say. Friday is going to be a gigantic pivot for everybody that's listening. I'm feeling it. So, Angela Myers, welcome to Drive Through HR.
Well, happy Friday, everybody. I cannot be more honored and excited to be spending it with you guys. What a great lunch date.
Oh, to say the least. So, if you would, introduce yourself to our listeners, and then we'll kind of jump off from there.
Oh, my gosh. 140 characters. So, I liberate genius, and I have been doing that in education 5 years. And now I have moved to the social web, and I work with businesses and industries and individuals to help them sort of live into and up to the genius that they're capable of. My official title is educator, writer, speaker, but my work every day is about recognizing that we are in the presence of genius, and 99% of the human beings over 5 years old hold it back, and it's our duty to one another to work on liberating it and nurturing it and ultimately leveraging it.
Let's get to genius and kind of cut that a couple different ways, because I know you're not just thinking pure IQ. Say genius, what do you give us some examples of what you mean by genius?
So genius is far too important a word to limit it to superheroes and scientists in the traditional way that we think of. The ability to bring genius to an individual or to open it up in yourselves is defined in the way we define it as an individual or an organization's ability to solve a problem in a way that it hasn't yet been solved, to make an impact that only they can make because of their background or their perspective or their insight, and to share their God-given gift to the world so that the world says, wow. And I never knew that I needed that just at that moment. Every single person has something that someone else in the world desperately needs. And it's our responsibility to contribute that and wait for those moments to happen.
What's really brilliant about that is, you know, if you've ever been touched by autism, you know, have friends, have kids or whatever else, there's a lot of genius there. I mean, first
Absolutely.
Of all, autism is a big, giant, broad spectrum,
Absolutely.
Right? And so there's all kinds of things in there, but there's so much genius in there. It's almost unapproachable. It's almost hard to kind of really feel
exactly.
and touch. Let's get your take on the workplace and genius. How should businesses unlock the genius at work?
So the deepest level of motivation of a human being, whether it's in the workforce or it's in the classroom, is their desire to matter. And more specifically, their desire beyond just simply being noticed and valued, their desire to be essential. And so we were born to make an impact, and we were born for significance. And so what happens is literally after 5 years old, we start hearing this ticker tape in our head, whether we hear it from the outside world or inside our own head, that says we're not enough, we can't do blank, we're not this, we're just that. And so gradually, over time, and yet all of a sudden, we are living a life of mediocrity. We're living a life where we let other people take the lead and lead us, and we hesitate, and we start letting fear define our decisions, and we start losing our brave that we were born with. And I think that's what is really important, is to look at not increasing employee motivation, but increasing our employees' chances of being essential to one another, to the customer, to people outside of the customer. And we don't do that because we define are employed by their job title, not by their character, not by who they are and what they can contribute. And I mean beyond their job title.
What's the relationship in your mind between that and risk and failure?
I think there's a really flipped idea of what failure is. When I work with children, that failure is an option. They absolutely understand that the bigger the goal and the more audacious the dream, the more times that it's going to take to get there. Fear is not an option. Failure is an option, but fear is not. So they demand of one another to keep questioning and keep imagining and keep pushing each other to think bigger and to poke the box, if you will. But adults flip that. They believe that fear is an option. In fact, it's the single option they default to when making a decision. And I define fear as false evidence appearing real. So if you really look what drives human beings, it's fear. And a lot of times that's in conjunction with ambiguity and safety and comfort. And so all of a sudden those decisions turn us into apathetic, complacent human beings that wait for somebody else to solve the problems that we are capable of solving ourselves.
Are you a fear of success, fear of failure person?
I don't really look at it in any of those terms. I look that, I actually think that the fear is greater, that our fear of success is far greater. I think Miriam Williamson has this famous quote that says our deepest worry isn't that we're not great, it's that we are actually incredibly great, and we just don't know how to handle that. It's been so long since we've sort of owned our own genius and really lived up to our capabilities. So I think the fear of success is far more terrifying than the fear of failure.
Inside of an organization, if I were to say teaching, training, and learning, and you could wave a magic wand and have it actually done correctly,
right,
how would we go about those things inside of an organization?
First of all, defining them as absolutely completely different. Teaching does not result in learning. Training certainly does not result in learning. It is what it is. It's delivery of content. And so you can have the most incredibly gifted trainer, and it doesn't guarantee that the individuals in the room will learn. Learning is an inside job. It's influenced by conditions, and that's what great teachers and great trainers understand, is they provide very scientifically the conditions in which they know learning will flourish. And if you do that, learning is inevitable, because learning is the most natural thing that we do as human beings. If you leave people alone, and there's massive studies about this. So there's a really great TED Talk where this guy computers and literally dumps them in the middle of the desert, and he just left kids alone, and they taught themselves coding. I mean, it's incredible. So learning happens naturally, but learning happens only under certain conditions. And we don't train trainers or organizations how to create the conditions of learning and then how to nurture people and coach people within those conditions. And so that's what I do for organizations. I help them create learning experiences. I don't deliver training. And part of that is teaching, but I don't deliver training. It's absolutely a complete waste of money. In terms of transformation, it might give you some surface level knowledge and you might see just temporary gains, but learning is about transformation, and the person leaves you different because of the experience with you. And I can't say that that is the case with training. People don't go, oh my God, my life has been changed, but they do after a learning experience.
Angela, on the from a learning experience perspective, where do pain and progress kind of derail? Because children definitely know pain and progress, right?
Absolutely.
And course
Absolutely.
Correct. Where do the wheels fall off of that we tend to lose that and then have to refind it when we get to adulthood?
So I think understanding that pain is a part of progress, the root word of passion is to suffer. So there's this misconception when we ask kids or we ask adults to sort of follow their passion or to do passion-driven work. There's this misnomer that we're asking them to have fun. Passion isn't even close to fun. Passion gets fun knowing that you are strong enough and wise enough and resilient enough to do work that matters with intensity and with tenacity. So that is all connected to purpose, and even more importantly, connected to higher purpose. So when people know why they're doing what they're doing, and if they know that that why is in service to something greater than that moment or themselves, they will literally go through anything to do it well. If you take a sports example, my son is in sports, and he's getting up by choice for a second practice at 5 in the morning. He's a teenager who loves sleep. Him and his buddies get up early in the morning, and they're actually training in wrestling right now while they were in football practice. And it's optional, but he understands that if they put themselves through this pain, they will become better contributors to the team. It will not only increase their ability to play the game, it will enhance their ability to be a teammate. And the commitment and the discipline is mind-boggling. Now, I can't get that in geometry for him, but from sport, because he's part of something bigger. He's not playing a football game. He is a part of a championship team, and that means something to him. And he's a valued member, essential to that team's success. We have to position that same frame in the conditions in which we do training.
Angela, what's your take on generations and learning?
I think there is an absolute significant difference. So I've been trying to think of what this generation, not the millennials, but the ones before them, the five-year-olds sitting in classrooms right now, and I call them generation innovation, because it is in their DNA to invent and to innovate and to move forward active change. And it's the first generation in our entire human history that's grown up in what I call the age of possibility. You and I, even the millennials, have experienced what it feels like to live and to learn in an age where limitations were actually realistic and barriers were something that we handled every day, and that really we got very few stories of what the scope of human ability is, and they were few and far between. When a man landed on the moon, nothing happened for 10 decades, or, you know, a decade later. They get to see impossible being defied literally every single day since they were born. And so growing up and learning and being a part of a world where the word impossible is only followed by not yet and seriously, it changes their DNA. So they're not just a connected generation. They are a conscientious, compassionate generation. And the act of not contributing or standing by passively letting somebody else is not even in their realm of thinking. And that's a really exciting thing. And adults, even millennials, can learn a lot from these young innovators and these young, you know, would-be entrepreneurs. But that doesn't mean that the wisdom of being able to do it and sort of save them from exorbitant amounts of pain that you and I went through to achieve whatever we needed to, that we can't be guides and we can't be wise co-learners with them. And that's what's amazing, is the smartest person in the 21st century in the room is the room. And we get to bring any single kind of learner in the room that we need. And we need every generation, and we need every perspective, and we need every genius, because the problems we're facing are needing nothing less than that.
Angela, let me do a quick reset. Everybody, you're listening to Drive Through HR, Brian and William. Having a fantastic conversation with Angela Myers. And so based on the comment you just made and the
yes.
generation of innovation, how do you feel communication is being redefined as we go forward?
Beyond just what we think about with social media, obviously that it is immediate, and, you know, what we need to understand is the reason we have this evolution in the web is it's driven by human needs. So humans need, first and foremost, to be noticed. They need to hear their name, literally. And the reason we checked Twitter 50,000 times is because somebody's saying our name. We're like, oh, my gosh, my name hasn't been mentioned for 18 minutes. I must be obsolete. You know, like, oh, my God, my life is over. Nobody's mentioned my name on Twitter, like, for the last 17 seconds. So it isn't an ego thing. It's DNA. And then we get to hear immediate feedback from people that said, what you did, what you shared was valuable to me. That triggers dopamine in the brain. That's like a drug. So when we say we are addicted, we're not addicted to the tool or the platform. We're addicted to what human beings thrive on. We're addicted to feedback. We're addicted to people saying, that mattered to me. I noticed you. I'm really glad you showed up in my stream today. Most importantly, the reason we stick with it is we want people to say, wow, I really needed that. That was so essential. Thank you. That was incredibly valuable. And we get to go on this path of self-discovery for what makes us most essential. And the more people that you can be of value to, the more you're willing to work, the more you're willing to take a risk and a chance. And so I think the shift in communication is now being a part of that real-time, you know, 140-character live stream, not data stream, but live stream, you know, life stream, if you will, is that I no longer see the web and the world as a place I go to get from other people. I also don't see it as a place where I simply go to interact and learn with other people. It's evolved what I call Web 3.0, the evolution that we are of the web and we're learning for other people. So everything that I read, everything that I see, like my automatic, our work today is how am I going to share this conversation with other people today? So it isn't just that I sent it out. I prepped my community, not that much, but I prepped them that I was going to be on this. And that what came up in this are links that will be valuable to the people that didn't get to hear it or only got to hear a part of it. So I'm automatically, by default, thinking, how am I going to share this? How am I going to curate this? How am I going to extend someone else's learning so they're not just passively listening in? They can do something, and that changes you. When you're learning for other people, your entire mindset is really, really different. Learning
that was a
becomes
great question.
Not a solo act.
Yeah. That was a great question, Brian, by the way.
Yeah,
really
great.
Let's go backwards for just a second, Angela. You had mentioned passion and purpose, and I really want to get your take on what if people don't know, and you know, like, and listen, no judgment, but what if people don't know either their passions or their purpose?
Right.
Where do you suggest that they start?
So this is really interesting because this has been the area of my intense study this year. A year ago, I would have said, they have to dig down. They have to learn where their heart is. I had this thing. I wrote an entire book on passion. And I had, you know, this is your passion detector. These are questions. And I still think that work is really important. Being self-aware is really important. What I have found more successful than the advice giving people, follow your heart, find your passion, is follow your heartbreak. Find and be driven by compassion. Because it is in the heartbreak that ordinary people discover their extraordinary abilities. And we see this in grand heartbreaks, like the bombing, like the shooting at high school. We see people coming out of the woodworks, literally, and the best of humanity shows up because they are being called on every way they can, and their only drive to be essential. They're not thinking of ego. They're not thinking of competition. They are thinking only compassionately. And it's contagious in a community. So it isn't just one neighborhood comes out because that's their feeder school. The entire nation came together in our country's greatest tragedies, from the Newtown shootings to the bombings to any single thing that's happening, even right now with the typhoon. The best of humanity comes out when the heartbreak is greatest. And so I'm taking kids and I'm taking young entrepreneurs and my own self through a process we call heartbreak mapping. And we literally follow the world's greatest heartbreaks. And what happens is genius shows up. And I learned the biggest lesson of my life this year, that if you don't give genius a reason to show up, it's not going to. Our brains are so protective biologically to hold on to comfort, to hold on to complacency, to not, you know, not push itself. Seth Godin calls it the lizard brain. The resistance in our own biology is massive, but when something is bigger than ourselves and we are needed, we will become superheroes, supermen and women. And you literally will look back and say, I didn't even know I was capable of that. I never would have imagined I would have done that. And that's when the real lessons start happening. And so that's the big shift.
I'm sorry, but I'm on a little bit of a delay. How do you do heartbreak mapping inside of a company? Or how would you propose HR or senior leadership take on an exercise? Because I'm with you. I've learned, usually when I failed is when I've learned the most, or through some type of pain, whatever that pain is, the personal
pain.
Absolutely. But how do we take that inside to a company?
I'm so glad you asked that. We just did this. I did a large distribution conference with about 200 of the top distributors in the country. And I was, you know, trying a really brave thing because this is only something I've done with students. So we looked at what are the biggest pain points. And if you don't like the word heartbreak, then just talk about pain points. What are your companies? What are your organizations? What are your customers' biggest pain points? And so this is just one example we did with a really large distribution company. It has 438,000 employees. And so they said right now it's their ability to provide customer service. So they're getting bad feedback on customer service. And so I said, so let's look at that. Is it because that they're not happy with the, you know, the product, they're not happy with this? And what we mapped it down to is the customer decides whether they feel valued in the first 2 to 6 seconds of an interaction. So we went back and we looked at all the email that and all the sort of marketing that goes out to customers, and it goes back to that core need of mattering and people needing to know their name. And all of the communication started this way: dear customer, dear customer, dear customer. So, well, how excited and how engendered and how personal does that feel? So there's software that can customize not only the name of the customer, but can customize the syntax and the tone and the framework. This is what Obama used during his campaign, that the way you would talk if your customer base is women is different than if your customer base was millennials, than if it was other CEOs. So you can even have an algorithm craft language that is natural and just that. So they looked at what their burn rate was in email, just doing this for 2 weeks, and it shifted 60%. From not only opening, but time in the document where they didn't even have an opening rate because they know it's going to be dear customer, how many of those emails do you burn? And then when it says, hi, Angela, you know, great to talk to you today or whatever, and they were saying, well, Amazon's our biggest competitor. And I said, here's why. Because what do you hear when you open up Amazon? Hi, Angela, great to have you back. I've got some recommendations for you. And you buy 10 times crap that you don't even need because some computer is saying your name. This is social science. This is psychology. This is neurobiology. This is not, you know, marketing is social science. So just a small shift. But we wouldn't have gotten there if we just said something like, oh, we're doing bad in customer service, or we're doing really bad in employee engagement. Those are big heartbreaks. So when we started really nailing it down, we said, well, what can we take action on immediately that can have the biggest impact? And it is, how can we have the first 6 seconds with customers sound different and feel different from them? So that's just an example. And it can be in any kind of heartbreak. So we picked sort of 6 of them. One was employees feeling like they don't matter because they are distributors. And so their middleman is being cut out every single second, and they're very threatened by social media, as well they should be. That's different than just employee environment, where there's not a lot of trust with the head leadership and not a lot of communication. That's a different heartbreak that required different actions. So we do these blanket things like we'll spend $1 million on employee engagement or $1 million on our marketing for a new product, and we're really missing what the core is of why people act the way they act.
Angela, do you think this is really more of the systemic generation now because of social media and getting that instant kind of feedback, instant kind of validation, or do you think this is just a timeless people wanting to connect?
I think there's a timeless element of absolute core DNA level human needs. that since the beginning of time, once human beings knew they had food, shelter, and water, that the next layer of need, DNA level need, is the need to belong and the need to know they are essential or that what they matter. And so what I think that social media provides is an amplifier of that. It's an amplifier of people seeking that, and it's an amplifier of our ability to be able to do that, to really be able to listen. One of the companies that I was having conversation this week is PepsiCo. And so they gave a really great example of using social media in the way that it should be used. And they were looking at sales of Gatorade plummeting. And so they came back and they used really powerful social analytics and social listening tools, set up an entire command center dashboard, and they found out not what people were saying about Gatorade, but what people were saying about when they did it. And they started hearing conversations about that they wanted something to give them energy before a workout, something to give them energy during, after, and they started collecting those dialogues and analyzing what people wanted. And then they provided that value. They repackaged Gatorade and said, this is the before workout formula. It's probably the same juice. This is the before workout formula, and this is the, and Starbucks is great, Zappos is great, and that's what we should do. When you feel listened to, when you feel heard, and then you start seeing changes in a product or service because of that, even if it's not, you know, even if Gatorade still tastes bad, the fact that they showed that the customers were heard, it's a winner, and it absolutely correlated into sales, absolutely, almost immediately.
Well, and that's, you know, it's awesome that listening helps solve their problem.
Absolutely.
What a new concept, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
so.
Shocking. And it's so funny to be working with businesses on this, because I go back to when you were five. If you did not notice every five-year-old that walked into your classroom and you were not waiting outside the classroom, I mean, you could not notice the littlest thing, like a kid would come up to you like, what is wrong with you? My barrette is on the left side of my head now, and you've missed it for 2 days in a row. You don't get anything. So if you don't secure their heart, you don't have a shot at their brains, and you certainly don't have a shot at their business. And we have not simply, you know, economics to back that up. We have neuroscience to back that up. And the level in which this is shocking news to companies is mind-boggling. They obviously have not been around five-year-olds who will not let anything happen until they are, till they've heard their name, till they are recognized, till they are noticed, and then you're ready to get on with the day. Human beings are not different at bigger than five. They just don't say it out loud anymore.
Right. Well, that is excellent. Angela, we've got about 2 minutes left, and I want
to... Oh, my God.
Quick.
I feel like I talked so much.
It was a great conversation. Absolutely wonderful. So, but tell us about your keynoting, your books, and let's use the most of the 2 minutes to just hear a little bit more about what you do every day, and then we'll wrap it up, and the week has been fantastic.
Oh, yay. So I have to, because I can't have the listeners be passive, so I am changing the world right now, and you all must help me. So we have a movement that has built around individuals that are finding their inner change maker, and it's called Choose to Matter. So you can find out about it at choosetomatter.org, and it's individuals that are taking action on the world's most complex issues. And most of that movement is being led by children. So we have almost 1 million children every week participating in what we call Genius Hour. They go through the hashtag Genius Hour, and they have 1 hour a week in schools that let them, and they work on answering the question, what breaks your heart about the world? And they are acting collaboratively and using collective genius to solve the world's most wicked problems. And they need industry, they need business, they need entrepreneurs, and they don't need help per se that they are worried that their idea is not scalable or audacious, but when they are noticed by grown-ups and when they are supported by individuals and when the world sees them as not just cute kids doing a really cute project, listeners to the work they're doing, everything game changes. So I would love you, your organization, your company. There's a million and one ways to be involved, from simply checking a tweet and sending a tweet to you know, just being interested, and what this can mean for a company is absolutely unbelievable. So it's called Choose to Matter, and it changes you from the inside out, and we would love you to be a part of the conversation with us.
Oh, that is wonderful. Well, unfortunately, we are out of time. Thank you so much for the lunch
date. Oh, my gosh, thank you.
It was fabulous. So everybody have a good rest of the day. Have a good weekend, and we're out of here.
Early in the morning, rise into the street. Light me up that cigarette, and I'll strap shoes on my feet. Got to find a reason.